Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant mother in this case, who I'll refer to by her initials, SF, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. We're asking the Court to reverse the termination order in this case because the Washington Termination of Parental Rights statutes are unconstitutional in violation of substantive due process, both facially and as applied to this family. The Washington termination statutes are unconstitutional because they routinely create legal orphans. The Washington Center for Court Research reports that of children whose parental rights are terminated, only about 40% are adopted within 6 months. DSHS reports that 3 or 4% routinely turn 18 without ever having a permanent family again. As of December of last year, that amounted to 567 children who were in Washington's extended foster care program. That's not all of the children who have aged out of foster care. That's only the ones who were aged out of foster care and also were eligible. There's strict eligibility requirements for the extended foster care program. Creating legal orphans is not a compelling state interest. It's a means to an end. And as a means, it's devastating to children, and it's not narrowly tailored to the state's goal of achieving permanency for dependent children. It's undisputed that the standard of review in this case is strict scrutiny. When the state's regulating in the area of the fundamental right to family integrity, it has to impose only that extent of regulation that's necessary to achieve a compelling state interest. And it doesn't do that in this case. When we look at the dependency period prior
to
termination.
When you say it, you're talking about the termination statutes?
Yes, Your Honor. I should have said they, I suppose, because it's actually sort of a combination.
Well, it's
of
not
statutes.
Just in this case. I mean, you're challenging the termination statutes as facially unconstitutional because, as I understand your argument, they permit termination without showing it is necessary to achieve permanency for the child.
That's correct, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that they treat parental rights as this monolithic entity that has to stand or fall together. When we look at the dependency period that precedes termination, there we don't treat parental rights as monolithic. Instead, we individually restrict them and carefully parse them out to protect the child while also maintaining family integrity to the greatest extent possible. Then suddenly termination comes along and we decide that all legal connection to this child, between this child and this parent, has to either rise or fall together. And that's simply not narrowly tailored.
Why doesn't the best interest of the child element available to resolve those kinds of concerns? All the other elements are met. It's not in the best interest of this child because we don't have adoption on the horizon.
We know from In Re Custody of Smith as well as In Re Parentage of CAMA that the best interest of the child standard is simply not, it's not enough when what you're dealing with is a fundamental right and you're looking at strict scrutiny. We don't know precisely what the contours of what would be enough, but clearly preventing harm to the child is certainly a compelling state interest. But when all you're looking at is who could make a better decision, the best interest of the child is not enough. If that were the case, then these grand parental visitation statutes in Smith and in Troxell and in CAMA would have been constitutional,
but
they aren't.
We now have several cases where not only this court, but Division II and Division III have looked at and analyzed these statutes and have concluded that the statutes are narrowly drawn to meet a compelling need, that being harm or imminent harm. So how is your argument different?
None of those cases, we're talking here about IJS, I assume, and TCCB and CB, none of those cases actually talk about separating out the parental rights. They talk about whether or not there's harm to the child. And certainly we agree that the statute requires proof of harm to the child in general. The difference is that harm to the child that's caused by the parent can be dealt with through restrictive orders during the dependency. There's no need to sever all legal ties to the child in order to prevent harm to the child. And we know that because...
So then there would never be a termination? I mean, from your brief, you say the only circumstance that would be appropriate for a termination is if there was an imminent adoption. Is that your position?
I should have put that in a greater context. If the state's compelling interest that we're talking about is achieving permanency, if that's what they're trying to achieve, then yes, we would need an imminent adoption to make that necessary. We can also envision a scenario where, for example, in the KMM case, the court determined that the mere thought of contact with her father was so devastating to this child that the mere existence of the legal relationship was actually harmful to the child.
So how do you make that distinction between permanency and harm to the child?
Well, the problem is the statute really doesn't require proof of either one of those things.
Well, but we've looked at those statutes and we've concluded. So you, all of our decisions are wrong about the conclusion that the statutes do require proof of harm to the child or risk of harm to the child. Are you taking the position we're wrong?
I think that it
we could all be wrong. That's fine. But,
I think the problem is the interpretation of the word harm. It's true that the statutes do require that there has been some harm to the child, but the question is, what is that harm related to, and can it be protected by means less than termination? So we're not disputing.
Well, but isn't that dependency?
Exactly.
And so when then, in your analysis, do we reach termination, and when is termination appropriate?
There would be two scenarios that I can think of where termination would be appropriate. One would be sort of the KMM situation where there's proof not just that the parent has harmed the child and that there needs to be some protection there, but that the mere existence of the legal relationship is harmful to the child. That's the distinction I would make. I think the previous cases make clear that some harm to the child is required, certainly, but they don't actually talk about whether the mere existence of that parent-child relationship is harming the child.
But don't we have evidence here, and now we're flipping into as applied, we have evidence here that the mere existence of the relationship was harmful to these two children.
It was not that the mere existence of the relationship was harmful, no. The trial court found that the mother's inconsistent contact with the children during
and her drug addiction
was harmful to the child. That's the type of thing that could be addressed through restrictions on contact in the dependency. And so I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
May it please the court, my name is Kelly Taylor. I'm an assistant attorney general on behalf of the Department of Social and Health Services. And the department is asking this court to affirm termination of parental rights as to MAFS and VFC. The termination statutes are constitutional because the state has a compelling interest behind the termination statute, and that is the preventing of harm to the children. And the statutes are narrowly drawn to meet that compelling interest. And we have a number of Washington cases that have repeatedly held that to be the case. The identification of the compelling interest comes from this court's ruling in the IJS case. And the compelling interest of preventing harm also encompasses the need to provide a stable and permanent home to the children. And that...
Well, isn't there a requirement that the state prove that?
There is. The F element does require... It can be proven in one of two ways. It definitely, what's relevant to the F element is that the child has prospects for adoption. So that F element does show that the statutes are narrowly drawn to meet the compelling interest in terms of permanency for the child.
And is adoption an option without termination?
No. The adoption statute presupposes that the child is already legally free. So... Unless that statute also is challenged, really, our whole statutory framework presupposes that the child is legally free before adoption takes place.
So if there's a child with no prospects for adoption, undisputed, termination is off the table?
No, because there could be that case where the relationship is so toxic. I mean, if you have a 16-year-old that's trying to jump out the second floor window, because she's had a visit with her father, which was the facts in the Washington State Supreme Court case, then that F element could still be proven. The other.
And what was the evidence here about adoption? Because as to one child, I think there was evidence that there were prospects. But as to the boy who had behavioral problems, there's some debate about whether the evidence showed there were any prospects for adoption.
Well, I understand that there were certainly facts for the boy had some significant behavioral issues. That's true. But it's undisputed and it's really uncontested that both of these children had prospects for adoption. That's finding of fact 3.9. I think I have that right. But it's an uncontested finding of fact. Finding of fact 2.39 is not challenged. And it states that the children have prospects for adoption. So that finding is followed by finding of fact 2.40, which goes on to show the court's concern for the harmful nature of the parent-child relationship in this case, because that finding states that the parent-child relationship itself was a barrier to the children achieving permanency. So in this case, for nearly 4 years, we had a dispositional order which permitted the mother to visit with these children, and her visitation was so intermittent that it was placing these children in what the court termed to be emotional limbo. They were experiencing negative emotional effects from the mother's intermittent contact. The court found that the children's relationship was rendering the children less able to form bonds with caregivers and created a barrier to integration into a stable and permanent home. And those findings were supported by the testimony of social worker Larry Nelson, who testified that when a child finally knows he or she is definitely not going back to live with a parent, that knowledge helps the child integrate into a new home. And that same social worker, who was very experienced, I think he had 22 years of experience as a social worker, he testified that when the child no longer views the creation of a new bond with a caregiver as, quote, somehow treasonous to the parent, then that frees that child up to bond with a new caregiver. And so, you know, these children, both of them, have very realistic prospects for adoption. And so in terms of the as-applied challenge, certainly this challenge fails.
Now, as to the older boy, the court found it was not in the best interest of the child to terminate.
Right.
And so what happened with that child, and was there any evidence about adoption as to that child?
Well, that child, parental rights were not terminated as to that child. The court found it wasn't in that child's best
interest.
Well,
the court continued the trial, so, it's a little unclear then what happened.
That was
legal limbo.
So that trial was continued. Parental rights were not terminated as to that child. But the basis for that was, as Judge Varela pointed out, the protection that is provided by the best interest statute. Because we're not dealing just with RCW 13-34-180, but we also have
34-190,
the best interest component of the termination of parental rights statutes, and that was what this court used to decide not to terminate parental rights as to the 13-year-old, the eldest child, and that was partly because the court was concerned that that child did not have prospects for adoption, also because his mental health therapist testified it probably wouldn't be helpful to him from a mental health perspective.
Regardless of what happened to the older child in this case, in general, if a court's faced with a situation with a child who's got tremendous special needs, doesn't have likely prospects for adoption, the biological parent isn't capable of caring for the child, all those other elements are met, and the court, but that's the only person who there's a chance to have, has any bond with the child, the only one who's going to send a Christmas card or a birthday present, what options does the court have then? The court continues the trial indefinitely? The court denies termination, and then we're faced with, well, now we need to resume the dependency, which is all about finding a way to cure the problems, which we've already decided are uncurable. Does the statute lack adequate remedies? Should there be some other remedy that's in play to deal with that kind of circumstance?
Well, the facial challenge, when the court looks at the facial challenge, the court looks to the statute as it's written. And as it's written, the statute incorporates those cases where that relationship is so toxic and permits termination of parental rights in those cases. And I think I maybe want to challenge the court's assumption that there are those children that just don't have prospects for adoption. In terms of the number of resources that become available after termination of parental rights, there's testimony that increases dramatically.
But you've necessarily cut off any legal relationship with the biological parent who may have, in my hypothetical, some bond, some level of a bond with the child.
Well, the statute permits under the best interest section of the statute that best interest is a case by case specific determination. So that permits the court either to terminate or not based on the court's determination as to whether the child has legitimate prospects for adoption. But children do have, certainly these children have realistic prospects for adoption. And because the statute is applied, it was constitutionally applied to these children, the facial challenge fails because there is this set of circumstances, which includes these children, that the statute was applied constitutionally, and for that reason, the facial challenge fails. I have a few seconds. I do want to just show, if I could, Table 2. We did get some just some data that I would ask the court to look at because the amici brief in particular presented a very gloomy picture. And I was somewhat relieved actually after reading the amici brief that when we got the data that things really aren't that bleak. We have the 2000, if we look at the most complete year for 2015 in terms of...
And this is part of your supplemental...
This is attached to the response to the amici brief, yes. So if we look at the most complete year and from 2015, 73.6% are adopted within 1 year. And if we look back a little further, 95% of the children from the 2011 are adopted at this point in time, and in 2012, also 95%, if we round up a little, those children have all now been adopted. So we are achieving adoption not within 6 months, but we are getting there if you look out over a span of a couple of years. Thank you.
Your Honor, the prior cases addressing this issue simply don't parse out precisely which aspects of the parent-child relationship are harmful to the child. And that level of parsing out and separating out what aspects of the relationship are causing the harm and regulating only those aspects is precisely what's required under strict scrutiny that requires a least restrictive alternative. We can imagine at least three different ways to make this statute less restrictive of fundamental rights. For example, we can wait to terminate until an adoption is imminent, essentially reverse the order, search for an adoptive family before the entry of the termination order.
How can you do that if the adoption statutes presume there's been termination?
Certainly we agree that termination is required for full adoption, but that doesn't mean that you have to do it 6 months ahead of time. That doesn't mean you have to do it a year ahead of time, or sometimes years ahead of time, where children fall into this legal limbo, this gap of legal orphanhood during this extensive period of time where they belong to no one. That's a devastating state of affairs for a child, and this is not a small number of children that are falling into this gap. The legislature's tried to address it three times in the last 10 years. First, by allowing children who remain alone for 3 full years to petition for reinstatement of their parents' rights, in 2011, extending foster care to age 21, and in 2014, requiring lawyers be appointed for children who are legal orphans for 6 months or more. The Office of Civil Legal Aid, that's tasked with representing those legal orphans, reports that they represent 750 to 850 young people at any given time. So this is not a small problem. This is a big gap that lots of children fall into, including these children. And just in terms of what's in, you know, the harm in this situation, I want to point to the testimony by Larry Nelson, the social worker. He said that actually an open adoption agreement in this case, where some level of contact or communication was provided, would actually be beneficial to both the mother and the children. But the fact of termination via trial excludes that from being even a possibility, because the parent is no longer any standing to enter into any sort of a relationship or a contractual agreement. So another less restrictive alternative, besides simply a two-part termination, where we instead remove the parent's right to object to an adoption instead of fully severing everything. Another less restrictive option would be we sever all the parent's rights except the right to potentially enter into an open adoption agreement if later an adopted family is found. This mother was essentially penalized by the fact that the state couldn't find an adoptive home for these children in time for her to enter into an open adoption agreement. She may have relinquished her parental rights if there had been a family available and they could have entered into an open adoption agreement. So we would ask that the court reverse and hold that the statutes are unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you.